The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 331 for Monday, May 16th, 2011.
The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in your questions, you send in your tips, we answer your questions, and together we all learn a little something more about the Mac and Apple. Here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
Here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
How you doing today, John?
I'm kind of down.
It is a dreary day here.
Yeah, I think the whole area is getting where we're going to get rained on. So yeah, it makes it kind of dreary, but
yeah.
But I'm happy to do the show, so that kind
good.
Of offsets
you know what? Then let's dive in. Ken writes, when I open the Finder and go to my Applications folder and view in List or Column view, all the apps are present. But when I go to Icon view, I get an empty folder that indicates 255 items, but no icons appear. It is the same on my Super Duper backup, and when I go to Time Machine, I get the same result as well. I've only done two things of consequence since discovering this. I updated iPhoto and I used a Clean My Mac program to gain some space. I'm using the latest version of Snow Leopard on a dual core Xeon Mac Pro with 14 gigs of RAM. When I click on the application icon in the dock, all the apps are present and the machine runs normally and applications open. They also open from the list and column views from the applications folder. Help! Who stole my icons? So, John, I started thinking about this, and
I don't think they've been stolen, though, because that was my initial thought, Dave.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'll tell you, my initial thought was maybe a cache file. But no, I think you got the answer. You got the right answer. But initially, I was thinking, is there a program? You know, maybe there's an icon cache or something. And just as an aside here, there are cache directories either in your library caches folder or home directory library caches. So initially, I thought maybe it was something there, but I don't think it is. And I looked through our favorite Onyx to see if there was a, you know, cleanup icon cache thing. And there wasn't.
Okay.
But I think you hit it. So that was my initial path, which was not entirely correct. Though those cache directories, I think, are good to know about, because I think some problems could be due to what's in those directories. And I think for the most part, you can whack whatever's in those directories and you won't ruin anything.
All right. So, you know, my first thought, just to troubleshoot this, was to boot from that Super Duper backup, right? And this way we'll be able to tell, is the problem, not boot from the Super Duper backup, but mount that Super Duper backup on another Mac, right? And see if the same problem happens, because that'll tell us if it's something wrong, some setting in the system on his main Mac, or if it's something about the way this folder's configured. My guess is that it is the latter. And that folder, when mounted on another Mac, will display exactly the same problem. And my guess is that somewhere along the line, something happened with a folder. I can't remember if it's a folder or a file, but that it's named .ds_store. And it is what retains all of the positions of all of the icons in a given folder. Resetting or rebuilding or simply deleting that file and forcing it to be rebuilt is the trick. And back to Onyx, that's how you can do it. If you go into Onyx and go to Maintenance, Rebuild, and then choose Display of Folders Content, that goes through and wipes out all the .ds_store files. You can actually narrow it down to just the Applications folder if you want. And hopefully that'll do it. I think it will, John. I think that's going to be where the problem is, because the files are still there. You haven't lost anything other than the ability to see them in icon view. So
I concur, because I think that's the purpose of that file is. So no one stole the icons. They just put them somewhere that you can't see them.
Either put them somewhere you can't see them, or somehow it got set to display them at a size far too small for,
right. You know,
maybe it set them to, you know, width zero or something. I don't know. And we may never know, but hopefully whacking that file and forcing it to rebuild will solve the problem. And that is always the prime directive, right? Solving the problem. It's always great to know what the problem was, but not mandatory. Solving the problem is necessary. Now, if it happens twice, now we want to know what it was.
Prime directive.
Our prime directive. That's
okay,
right, John.
Jean-Luc. Got it.
All right, let's go to Tyrone.
Hey, guys, this is Tyrone from Hiram, Georgia. I know, second call in a week. Wow. Anyway, I'm listening to a show from October. I know it's May, but that's just how I roll. Seriously, I'm one of those people who I download a bunch of podcasts, and then I just take a month or two, actually 3 months, just listening to them all, and then I go and download a bunch more. I don't do it every day. The thing about it is I got a feeling a lot of people do like that, maybe not to that extreme, but a lot of people don't download a podcast every day and listen to it and then go download the next one and listen to it to their iPod. The thing about it, there is no good way when I finish listening and I have to go go back and, you know, I download a bunch more, like 500 or 600 podcasts, literally. And there's no good way to get rid of the ones that I've already listened to on the iPod, because iTunes, I didn't listen to them in iTunes. I listened to them on the iPod. So iTunes doesn't think I listened to them. And it's like a manual one by one by one at a time to delete all those podcasts that I've already listened to. I don't want to delete. And I have them in a smart folder. I say everything that was downloaded before this date, here's the list. And it'll have all of them, and that's my playlist. But you can't go in and delete everything in that playlist and just delete it. You have to, like, go back into the podcast and, like, go through each one and just, okay, delete this one, delete these five or whatever. I gotta believe I'm not the only person with that problem. And it seems like, I mean, I went to the Apple store and I talked to them, and you would think that that would be, you know, the way people listen to podcasts in bunches, maybe 10 or 15 at a time, but they don't listen to them in iTunes. And it seems like there's no way to just mass delete a bunch of podcasts without deleting your subscriptions, you know? Anyway, if you guys know anything way around that, you know, let me know if I'm doing something wrong. This is where you cut me off, but
all right. So I have a couple thoughts about this. Number one, I want to explain the way I interpret the way he listens to podcasts and what he's talking about. So he does. He goes and downloads a bunch of stuff and then puts that he has a smart playlist, not just of any one podcast, but he might have a playlist that's got us and Maccast and No Agenda or, you know, whatever podcast he listens to. And then he syncs that playlist to his iPod. He wants to know how to go into that smart playlist and select a group and delete them. And actually, I'm going to give you that answer, and I'm going to give it to you right now. It's Option Shift Delete. It's not in any menus. Near as I can tell, it's not in any help files. But if you hold down Option Shift and hit the delete key on the keyboard, it will ask you. If you're in a playlist, regular playlist or smart playlist, Option Shift Delete, boom, it will delete or offer to trash all of the files that are the source of all of those items in the smart playlist. Don't know why it's not in a menu, John, but it's not in a menu. So once, but with that said, if you've, there are some other options. In iTunes, you have the ability to tell it to remove podcasts that you've already listened to. But that requires syncing from the iPod back to iTunes. And for whatever reason, maybe based on your workflow or whatever, Tyrone, maybe that's just not an option for you. But otherwise, it will do that when you, well, I guess you have to go into iTunes and click refresh on the podcast. And that's when it'll go and delete old ones and then go and download new ones. But of course, you don't want to download new ones. So therein lies the rub. But yeah, Option Shift Delete should solve that for you. Any thoughts on this, John?
Of course.
Good.
Well, no, what I looked at, and I think this may, what I'm going to suggest, so there are settings for each podcast. Now, there are default settings, but you can disable the default settings. And the one I notice is that there's one called Episodes to Keep.
Okay.
And he may want to set it to Episodes to Keep All Unplayed Episodes, because it sounds like he wants to ditch the ones that he's played already. Yes?
Well, that's what I'm talking about, is that setting. But if he's not syncing back from his iPod to his Mac, he won't know about that, right? So,
right. The thing I want to point out is that normally there's a use default and then there's a customize. So either his default is not set up the way he'd like, or he may want to customize depending on the particular podcast. But no, you're right. It's within iTunes and it doesn't happen on the device.
Right. So. Right. And in order to get that to take effect, as I said, you've got to either manually or via schedule refresh all of your podcasts. And it sounds like he doesn't want to download more podcasts yet. And so that puts him in this odd situation. But Option Shift Delete's handy, not just for Tyrone, but for everyone. A lot of times, if you want to clean stuff out of your iTunes library, the easiest thing to do is to create a smart playlist and then delete all the items from the playlist. But you have to know that secret handshake in order to do it. So Option Shift Delete. That's my feeling.
Okay.
All right. Our first sponsor for this show is Circus Ponies Notebook at circusponies.com. Very, very cool app. The idea behind it, John, is that, and you know this, John, because I've told you before and we've told all our listeners, unless you're new.
Tell me again.
I will tell you again. It creates a white line notebook view on your Mac. And the cool thing is you can put anything you want into these. The idea is you'll create multiple notebooks for different subjects or topics or whatever. If you could have a notebook full of recipes, and the cool thing is you don't just put text in there. You could pull a picture in or a link or maybe an audio. You could recorded some audio notes or you could put those in there too and bundle it all together and have, you know, a separate page for each recipe and one notebook for all of your recipes. You can pull in things and augment them and annotate PDFs and put sticky notes in and all that good stuff. And of course you can type. Then you could create a notebook for a project you're working on at the office or a class you're taking. You can search throughout an entire notebook using their multi-dex, which allows you to search based on what you know about the information. So if you forget what you typed, but you know what day you typed it, you can search based on a date and it'll pull up everything in that notebook that happened on that date or in that date range. The same is true if you tagged it or did something else. You can search by what you know, which is key. Then it gets even better because there's notebook for the iPad and you can sync your notebooks back and forth between the iPad and the Mac. You can create or edit on the iPad while you're out and about, pull it back. Or if you've got all your recipes in a notebook and you want to put it on your iPad, so you've got it right there in the kitchen, boom, no problem. And if you're going to bring your iPad in the kitchen, a Ziploc bag is a great thing. Big gallon Ziploc bag protects it and still lets you use the touchscreen. So Circus Ponies Notebook for the Mac is available as a free trial from circusponies.com. And then once you're hooked, it's $49.95 for a standard license and $29.95 for an academic. Notebook for the iPad, $29.99 at the App Store. And if you've got an iPad, you know what the App Store is. circusponies.com. John, last week we talked about a potential malware, I'll say, in show number 329. And Dave wrote in, he says, I wanted to comment on the malware section of 329. The caller, Kevin, had an issue with something called Mac Defender. I wanted to mention that I also had a client who had Mac Security, and that was the same malware from an unknown source. This was on Monday, only a day before I heard your show. Intego, and I normally hesitate to mention Intego, John, because they stand up and scare everybody all the time. But they actually produced an excellent video that shows exactly what you'll see if you get this virus. And the cool part, it's very interesting. It brings you to a website that looks like it's, you know, a Windows thing scanning your computer. If you hit the cancel button, that's when the cancel button cancels nothing or appears. It appears to cancel it. But really what you're doing is triggering a download of this disk image to your Mac. And then, of course, once the disk image mounts, if your Mac is set to launch save files, it comes up and says, do you want to install? So so that's how they did this. You are performing an action, but it's hitting that cancel button is the key to trigger the download. So thanks, Dave, for sending that in. Hopefully this is short-lived and isolated because installing antivirus software on my Mac is against my religion, John.
You know, I'm going to break it out into two different types of antivirus, Dave.
Okay.
Move on here. But to me, there are two major classes. There's one, and I think Intego's falls into this class, which I would agree with you, makes me nervous, is stuff that is active and that it's watching over your shoulder all the time.
Right.
Then I see stuff that I would consider more passive.
Yep.
That if you initiate a scan, then it will look. Now, it's of course not as effective, but it doesn't get in your way as much.
Right.
And I think I actually saw this mentioned on our Facebook page. One of our folks mentioned, I think there's something called Virus Barrier, which I believe that's is more in the... Oh, it is them. Okay.
Huh?
So I wonder if that if they have different products because... Yeah, I'll have to look here because I got something in the app store. But I thought there were two different classes. But yeah, in general, they get in the way and... Yeah.
Yeah.
It's too bad. I think the overriding issue, Dave, though, is... user education. And we had a spirited discussion on the latest Mac Roundtable about this. And one of the folks on the panel used a, well, said something not so nice about users that do this, which classified them a certain way, which I would just say uneducated.
Well, I mean, uneducated about viruses, sure. But, you know, here's the thing, having seen
if
this.
If someone comes up asking you to do something, you should be cautious, and I think we mentioned it last time, you should be suspicious. If all of a sudden you get an installer coming up saying, hey, you know, it's time to... No, here's the one I found. So I looked at my app store, and Virus Barrier Express, I believe, is kind of the lightweight one that they make.
Okay.
And from what I've seen, I've used it. I haven't installed, and I don't believe it installed anything that's sitting in the background. And I think there are a few others that are like that.
All right.
But I'm with you. Yeah, the yeah, I mean, it slows you down. It can get in the way. I mentioned one that, you know, crashed my system when I tried to run it. So I hope I think it calls for, and from what I've seen, a lot of people, including us, are doing this, is to educate people that if you see an installer all of a sudden start up, you know, don't say yes.
Yeah, the problem, if this continues, the problem could be, or could turn into something like we saw on Windows for years and years, which is that the stuff's getting installed along with other things and you don't realize it. And then before you know it, your machine is full of, you know, either viruses or spyware, which is, you know, very similar, but not quite the same, or both. And it just turns it into a disaster. So that's completely without you, the user, knowing that you've done anything to trigger the installation of this. That's the definition of a true virus, right?
Well, yeah. To me, a virus is something that requires no user intervention. And Actually, I believe Skype recently had something where if you received an attachment, it would, what happened is the attachment was done properly and you accepted it, it would then compromise the root account on your machine. So even then, that was something suspicious. If all of a sudden out of the blue, you get somebody sending you a file attachment and you accept it, or you're set to automatically accept it. Again, that's something that's, you know, doesn't happen often. I mean, how many people randomly send you pictures on Skype or attachments?
Right.
I don't know.
Right.
In my situation, whenever I get one, it's somebody that I know. It's typically you or someone else on the TMO crew that's sending an image or something like that. So I trust and I know who they are. But if I got, you know, Foxy something 123 sending me an attachment, I'd be like, yeah, you know, I don't know who you are.
Right.
And you should be set. And I assume I haven't looked in detail, but there should be a setting saying do not by default accept. Well, I think Skype does this. This says, you know, do you want to accept this attachment? And my answer would be no.
Right.
I mean, the other thing is that in Safari, there's the general and open safe files after downloading, which you may want to disable that because I think that was the core of some of these attacks is that you would get a disk image or a zip file or something and it would launch the installer. And then most people would say, oh, well, I better install this. So,
right. Right.
Yeah, it's opened up a can of worms, which, you know.
I hope it closes very quickly, you know, and this is very selfish because I just don't like running virus protection software. But I also know that if you're, you know, in the Windows world and it's been this way for a long time, you have no option. You have to run virus protection software. That it's just hands down. No question about it. It's the first thing you put on a machine. And it stinks that's how it is, but that's how it is. Mm-hmm. I hope we don't get there. I like to think that from what I know, Mac OS X is less susceptible to these. I realize it's also been less of a target because of lower market share, but I also think it's less susceptible. I mean, even this one, you've got to agree to several steps before this thing gets installed. I hope that, you know, hope we're... like I said, I hope it's short-lived. All right. Tom wrote, I've been thinking about upgrading my iPhone 3 to an iPhone 4. I wanted to wait on an iPhone 5, but my wife's BlackBerry isn't well, and she wants a new phone soon. My question is, when I sync the new phone to the computer, is just the apps going to transfer, or will the data in the apps transfer too? For example, will the items on my to-do app and the items in my grocery app transfer, or will I have to write them out and type them into the new iPhone? I'm sure there's something about this on Apple's website, but I sure couldn't find it. All right. Yeah, the answer is yes. As long as you follow these steps, and I've done this a couple of times, take your old iPhone and back it up. And if you sync it on your computer, that will back it up. And then when you plug the new iPhone in to iTunes, you go through the, you know, setup process, and at some point early on in the process, it asks you, is this a new device or are you restoring it from an old device? And you can restore an iPhone 4 with the backup made from an iPhone 3. And the beautiful part is all your settings and all that stuff just come right on through. No problem at all. And as we mentioned in the last show, if you encrypt that backup in iTunes by checking that little box, well, then you also get your passwords through. So very, very handy stuff. Yes, it will work fine and shouldn't be a problem. John, have you didn't, or did you? You did restore from your iPod Touch when you got your iPhone, or you started fresh?
No, when I synced it for the first time, it did sync the apps that had been on the iPod Touch and sync the ones that were appropriate for the iPhone.
Okay. But you didn't restore from the backup of the iPod Touch when you were setting up your iPhone. You didn't choose that
option. No.
Okay.
No, I ran the activation, whatever it was, and I think at some point it said, oh, there's some apps here. It may have said to me, hey, would you like to sync the apps that are ready in iTunes? And I said, yeah.
Well, no, sure. It's not so much syncing the apps. It's the data itself. The apps aren't part of the restore, believe it or not. It's the data that is. It's interesting. In fact, I just came across a cool app for in the jailbreak store called Data Deposit, and it lets you take all of that data and back it up per app to like Dropbox or somewhere else. And the cool part is, you know, the author used the example, you could take like your high score list from a game on your iPhone and move it to your iPad. He said you can take your Angry Birds data and move it back and forth and it'll work seamlessly, or at least it did for him. Ooh. which is pretty cool, because that's, you know, I mean, it, you know, it's fun, right? So there you go.
Well, no, I like that, because actually I haven't played it for a while, but that was one of the few apps that I bought. Mm-hmm. And my expectation was that when I synced it to one device and then the other, that it would bring over my play data, and it didn't.
You'll have to jailbreak to do that, baby.
Well, I think they're working on it too. I think it's a useful feature if you're owner of the app and you have multiple iDevices. I think they would like it so that you could not have to start from the beginning.
Right.
I certainly didn't really enjoy starting from the beginning again.
No, it stinks to have to start from the beginning. Yeah, I'm with you. Yeah. All right. Let's go to Jeffrey. And Jeffrey probably opens up a can of worms here, but we like that. Jeff says, I know you've touched on various forms of backups in various situations, but I'd love your thoughts on the best way to back up my photos. My question centers not so much around the backup as the organization preceding the backup and in what format to backup. My photo album transitioned from physical to electronic about the time my son came on the scene, and I'd like to be sure I have solid means of preserving that history. The relevant issues are that I have individual photos of various types, including JPEG and RAW, within and outside of iPhoto, mostly within. And I've transitioned across several computers over the past 10 years or so, and sadly, still haven't centralized all the photos. Obviously, that's a part of this goal. I've heard you discuss iPhoto Library Manager and other applications, and I'm wondering if this is a good use for these. Should I put all the photos into a central library like iPhoto, then back up via the usual mechanisms, or perhaps export individual photos and save them that way? This is the best part about his question. Feel free to pontificate ad lib. That's right. As if we would do anything else. That's right. So thanks, Jeff. John, you go ahead. I have some thoughts on this. I know you do.
I'll give you my initial thought, and this is what I've done. So I have probably for about 10 years now kept my photos, digital photos, in Apple programs. All right. So iPhoto, and then of course I recently migrated, and that was pretty smooth.
Yep.
Migrated over to Aperture.
Right.
You know, I lost some stuff, but all the photos were retained. So I would say that's the first thing you want to do is back up that library file, which is actually a package, which is actually just a folder full of other folders, which includes your pictures.
Multiple copies of your pictures, potentially.
Right, because if you make changes and it has thumbnails and stuff like that. So yeah, so there's your original stuff plus more. So right. So that'd be the first start, assuming you're going to stick with Apple for your photos. But the only thing I would suggest is that in addition to that, so iPhoto itself, if you highlight a bunch of photos, so if you go into the library in the photo tab, you'll see all your photos and you could highlight them all. And one thing you may want to do is there's an export feature. And if I'm looking at it right now, so and you get a number of tabs because you can install plugins and all that fun stuff. But the first one is file export.
Okay.
And there are a number of options here. And what I would do is on occasion, so I would stick to, so the first question is what should I stick to as the format to preserve them in? And I think it's a safe thing to say that the thing is I don't do anything with RAW right now, but okay. I do JPEG. So,
okay, sure.
And JPEG has served my needs for 10 years, and I think it will in the future. So one thing would be to select the photos that you want. You know, how you organize it is up to you. Personally, what I do, at least in iPhoto, is I have albums, and they are time, month and year stamped and the name of the event. So one thing is you may want to just consider moving forward or moving back. You may want to key your albums to a month and a year for future sorting purposes.
Now, how would you remember? So he's going to save these albums. How would you remember? How would you recommend he do that? So he's got them organized now. And I realize he asked more about the organization than the backup. But to make this, you know, a little bit more widespread here, how would you then back those up? What medium would you put them on? What process would you file?
Medium, that's a good one. All right. Well, the first thing is that in file export, there are choices. So I'll give you that first. So file export photo of a portion of iPhoto, there is kind. And I would probably go with original, which is the original format that it's in. And I'll pick it right now here. Or if they're all JPEGs, any other JPEGs, then you say JPEG and they have a JPEG quality menu, in which case I would say maximum. I would not degrade them. Size.
You're gonna degrade them if you convert them to JPEG as opposed to leaving them in original form. Risk losing some data or changing it. I mean that's part of JPEG is lossy.
Understood.
Lossy compression, right? So, yeah. No, I just wanted to get it out there.
No, you're right. Well, potentially because you can say do no compression.
True. That's right.
But normally, yeah. I mean, the point of JPEG is that it eliminates. What some may consider redundant data, and it makes it smaller than the original. But you know, if you're going to export, at least in iPhoto, make sure that you choose the maximum quality so that you don't lose anything, size, full size. So that's one thing.
Okay.
So you may want to use an export. Now, as far as the naming, what I would do, because the thing is, and this came up actually in the past, or I've had conversations with people, Aperture, unfortunately, in its library section, isn't too smart about sorting by date. And as a matter of fact, it doesn't sort by date in a certain tab. So what you may want to consider is when you name your albums or whatever your unit you use or your folders, you may want to think about a strategy of using perhaps the year and then the month to sort them.
Yep.
Because if you sort them alphabetically, then the file system should sort them in some sort of order that makes some sort of sense.
Right.
That's what I'm going to suggest.
So
as far as the medium.
Yeah.
That's a good one. I would say, you know, our recurring theme of avoiding a single point of failure is, you know, heck, maybe Dropbox would be nice. Certainly a hard drive. I would discourage or be careful of optical medium because as you may or may not know, Dave, optical mediums will degrade.
Right.
Write once mediums tend to have longer lifespan. Rewritable tend to have shorter lifespan. So I would say the write once mediums could be on the order of 100 years or at least in the high tens. Whereas the rewritable media, from what I've heard, tend to be on the order of tens of years.
Right.
Because the dies and whatever break down.
Sense.
I mean, the benefit is that they're rewritable. The bad news is that they're not going to last this long. So, and I'll find an article that goes in more detail about this. But keep that in mind. Optical media will degrade. quicker.
Well, and remember, hard drives, we learned something right. interesting a number of years ago, I think in having a similar discussion, where what we learned was that hard drives, if they're spinning, they'll retain their data unless there's some damage to the disk, right? But a hard drive on the shelf for more than about, I think it was about 6 months, will start to be impacted by the Earth's magnetic field. And yes. if it's not spun up every, on a regular basis, the data will start to shift. You know, zeros may become ones and ones sure, may become sure. zeros. And
Cosmic rays or.
Well, I don't think it's cosmic rays. I don't think putting a tinfoil hat over your hard drive is going to help.
Oh, no, but I think cosmic rays could. No, I'm being serious. But
oh, OK. All right.
Now here's another. You may think this is an offbeat, off the wall or over the wall or under the wall suggestion.
And through the woods.
Here's another. If you have some particularly valuable photos, you may want to kick it old school and actually print them.
Hmm.
Do not rule out physical medium as an archive.
Right. Right. And
there are some documents, from hundreds or thousands of years ago, if preserved properly. And that's the only thing I'll bring up.
Sure.
Like an our buddy who I haven't seen in a while, Wes, would collect comic book collectors.
Right. Right.
You know, some of them are tens of years old. Now, if you just leave them sitting on a table somewhere in the sunlight, yeah, they're going to fall apart. But if you store them properly, maybe in a, humid room with proper humidity inside a good, a baggie or something like that. So things that are very valuable. So number one, have multiple save options. Number two, for valuable photos, you may want to print them out. You know, get some nice photo paper, get some, decent ink or colored laser. I prefer ink myself.
Yeah, ink's going to look better than laser for photos, for sure. Yeah,
I think it'll last longer if you get some quality ink.
I would actually recommend going, instead of driving yourself crazy trying to print them, you can find, my daughter just sent a bunch of stuff to Shutterfly. And they've always got deals and things that are pretty cheap. And so she just uploaded a bunch of pictures. There were a couple, one that I had actually taken on my iPhone. I guess it was my iPhone 4 last summer. And I couldn't believe it, how great it looked. It was an outdoor shot. It was well lit, with natural light and all that stuff. But Shutterfly does a good job. And probably... I'm not sure that it's any more expensive than printing on your own and buying ink and all the paper and all that stuff. Shutterfly can buy that stuff in much greater quantities. So, it's worth checking it out. There's more than just Shutterfly, of course. I just have them on the mind because we just ordered a bunch from there. So, all right, cool. All right, let's, where are we time-wise here? Yeah. You know what? I want to talk about our second sponsor for this show. It is a relatively new sponsor, and that is Stitcher. Stitcher it's pretty darn cool. Stitcher is an app for your iOS device, either your iPad, your iPhone, or your iPod, and it lets you listen to episodes of podcasts. Mac Geek App, of course, is in there, on the go. You don't have to sync with your computer. You don't have to download. You don't have to wait for anything. As long as you've got connection, you just press the button and off you go. And the best part is the app is free. So you can go to Stitcher. When you install, it asks you if you have a promo code. Now, something very cool happens here. You can use our promo code, which is MGG. And it does two things. Number one, it will automatically add Mac Geek Gab to your Stitcher right there in the device. So you don't have to go and search us out. We'll be right there. And number two, it enters you into a drawing to win an iPad 2. So a little incentive there, but they're making it easier for you anyway. So you can visit it on the web at stitcher.com/MGG. But really, your best bet is to just go and download it from the App Store, because that's going to get you there. And then just don't forget that coupon or the promo code MGG. So, and they have them for iOS and Android. And I maybe even BlackBerry. I don't have that in my notes that they gave me here, but for some reason I seem to remember BlackBerry, but certainly iPhone and Android, and the promo code works on both. So they are platform agnostic, as all good service companies should be. Stitcher.com/MGG. It's good stuff.
I did it.
You did it. Did you install it? Yeah.
I did. It was seamless. Yeah. They asked for the promo code. It downloaded the app on my iPhone and sure enough, Matt Geekab was right there.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I was able to bask in the glory of listening to myself.
And you were able to press play and it just worked, right?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very, very seamless. So, yeah. I tried it out. It's on my iPhone and I'll have to add a few other podcasts, I guess.
Cool. Yeah. It really does make life simple. So it's good stuff. And we appreciate the sponsorship. All right. Now let's see. We've got a good one to pass back and forth a little bit here. John David writes,
yes.
I'm traveling to Europe this summer and plan to take a lot of pictures. The ideal scenario is that I leave my MacBook at home and travel with my iPad and DSLR camera. I want a solution that allows for ease of storage that minimizes the chance of loss. I figure a portable hard drive is out as there is no way to transfer the files from the camera to the hard drive. This leaves me with two options. Buy a bunch of SD cards and hope I don't lose any, or purchase an iFi card as I will have access to Wi-Fi. I'd appreciate your thoughts on this. All right, John, go ahead. You're Mr. iFi, so let's start there and see where our path weaves us.
Well, let's break down this question.
Okay. Because
I think it has a number of aspects to it. So you certainly heard of the iFi. So, uh-huh. but let's step back and let's make sure
we explain what the iFi is at some point here too. Let's start from the beginning. Okay.
So what he has is a digital camera with an SD memory card,
right?
And an iPad,
right?
And he has these two devices, and he would like to do photo management.
And he has Wi-Fi access.
And he has Wi-Fi access. So with all of these devices, can he do anything? And my answer would be no. As far as photo management. Beyond storing them on an SD card and dealing with them later. Okay. Can we agree on that as a starting point?
We can. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Now, step one, I'm going to say is, well, you could purchase a hardware device. So let's start there. And now we have one proposed, but I'm going to go to one that, if you don't mind me referring to the past here a little bit, but in our pre-show discussion. So there is a device that can be used to allow you to use your photos with your iPad. And I think that's a good place to start because I think that's the very basic and probably the least expensive. So I want to address this from a number of angles. One is cost and another is redundancy.
Right.
And I think the first one is that we'll start with, and maybe I'll hand it to you because I think you've actually used this, Dave, but Apple offers the camera connection kit.
Yep. It's cool. So this camera connection kit is called the iPad.
Do you have it?
Yes. Oh, yes, I do.
Okay.
Oh,
yeah. So you know more about it, but I think that's a good place to start because I think it's the least expensive option.
Yep.
But it's a place to start if you want to take photos from a camera and put them into the iPad. So go.
Yeah, it does. It does a lot more than that, too. So the camera connection kit really is two pieces of hardware. One is a dock connector with an SD card slot on the other side. So you plug into your dock connector, you plug the SD card in, and this will work on an iPhone too. It's not just limited to the iPad. You plug that in and then you can import photos from whatever's on the SD card into your iDevice and then use them in any app that can see your photo library. And there are tons, right? So you could do your photo management there. And we'll talk about a couple of the apps in a little bit. But the other piece to the camera connection kit is a dock connector to USB port. And the reason for this is if your camera uses some other type of medium, you know, you might need to get a USB-based card reader or whatever, and you can plug that in. And that works. But it also works to plug in keyboards and various other devices. So it can be pretty cool. And you can also connect using a USB to another dock connector and essentially making a two dock connector on, you know, one dock connector on either end, you can plug an iPhone into an iPad and slurp the photos from the iPhone into the iPad that way. So, it's one of the coolest things. It's like $30 from the Apple store. When it came out, you couldn't find them because everybody went nuts to get them.
Right.
But for $30, it is so useful. So there you go.
Now, you know, I think I'm going to get one but now let's kick it back. So that is certainly, I think, the least expensive.
Yeah, and you could totally.
It's $30, right?
Yeah, and you could totally, you know, unless you're taking a lot of pictures in RAW format, which you might be with a DSLR, but you know, unless you're using RAW, I can't imagine that you're going to fill up, you know, even 5 gigs over a vacation, right? So you could offload them to your iPad, and then at least that way you've got them on your SD card and your iPad.
Right.
And, you know, okay. 2 points.
So I'm with you. So that's step one. Yep. Now, then let's go to the next option. So the next option, as he pointed out, is the iFi card.
Right.
And what is the iFi card? I'm going to tell you what it is, though you probably know. The iFi card is an SD card. So fortunately, he's using an SD card. They do not make one for CF or other formats. It's just SD.
Okay.
But it's a SD memory card that also has a little Wi-Fi radio in it. And what does this buy you? It buys you a whole bunch of things. And you know, I got to say, I'm a big fan of them because they have evolved this product over time to do all sorts of different things.
You know, they've got no competition, and yet they continue to innovate like they do have competition to beat.
I think they have limited competition. Maybe. There are some camera vendors who attempt to put Wi-Fi in their cameras,
right?
But they all fall very short of the functionality that the iFi offers. So I think they're at the top of their game, and yeah, they keep innovating, and I think they're way ahead of everybody else. And I think some camera vendors actually are including the iFi card just because it's so great. And I've used it for it. So here's to talk about our discussion about ways to get photos from your camera into your iDevice. They just introduced a new feature, which is only in the X2 series of their cards, which is the latest release of their card.
Okay.
And what they have is something called Direct Mode. And it's, I would say, equivalent to the camera connection kit, in that what it does is, instead of it being a physical device that you plug into your iPad or your iDevice, it uses the Wi-Fi radio in your iDevice and makes it a little baby access point. And basically what happens is, if you set up both your iDevice and the iFi card, this is perhaps the only downside, is that you need to configure the iFi card with a machine using a USB adapter. Okay. So you have to set it up and say, okay, enable what's called Direct Mode.
Okay.
On the card. Though I think their app on the iDevice, I think, will also let you do that. But keep in mind, for doing some things with the iFi card, you do need a computer with a USB port. So you plug the SD card and then you use their iFi manager software to perform some functions. So that, I think, is maybe the only downside. But what it does is, once you take the pictures on your SD, on the iFi enabled camera, and your iDevice is available, it pushes them in. So it's the equivalent of sucking them out using the camera connection kit. And it appears in the same place. It appears in the camera roll.
Yep.
Which is the place that you normally keep your photos in the iDevice. And they're not downgraded or anything. They're the full resolution photos.
Sure.
And it puts them in there. And the other thing is, they offer, and then I want to move to maybe perhaps a little redundancy. So that's the first place to start.
Yep.
But then there's the matter of applications that could do something beyond.
Yep.
Beyond that. And I'm going to start with the iFi application.
Okay.
And I won't go into all the details, but they also offer an application that you can run on your device. And it can let you do a number of things. One of which... Well, you know, let me step back.
Imagine you would have to run the app in order to get the pictures from the iFi to the iPhone. You have to run some kind of app. It's not just going to...
You do, but if it's set up properly, then it will, kind of in the background,
happen. Got it. Okay.
But here's the other thing. So let me take a little tangent. The other mode you can put the iFi card into. So one is, for the sake of redundancy, you can push the photos from the iFi card into the iDevice.
Right.
That's running the iFi software or the iFi app. The other thing that you can do, and this is what I think is even a little bit cooler, that goes beyond the connection kit, is the iFi card also, if it's in within reach of an iFi access point or a Wi-Fi access point, or a lot of places will have, now I'm not sure about the availability in Europe, but if you set it up beforehand to go to an access point, it can upload photos straight from your camera to a huge number of sites. Flickr, YouTube, some are photo only, some are photo and movie, some are movie only. But you can set up the iFi card, so, and you can also tag the photos. Depending how you set up the iFi card, you can say, okay, photos that I explicitly mark as ones I like to upload will get uploaded, as long as you're near either open access point or one that you've configured beforehand, will upload them straight to Flickr, to Mobile Me, to all these services. So I think that's kind of cool. Now, it kind of gets you that redundancy, is that right. It's not only on the card, but then it could be on Flickr or Mobile Me. And those are the services that I used. And then it's also available to people who may want to, either you by using a browser, or other people could then see your photos immediately. The only caveat is you have to be near an access point.
But all of this requires an iFi card.
Yes. Yes.
Got it. Okay. So I kind of researched this from a different standpoint because I don't use an iFi card, but I do have an iPad. But I still didn't have the right answer. So I asked on Twitter this morning what people recommended to sync photos or offload photos from my iDevice to some other source. Now, what would be perfect would be to have a hard drive that I could plug into my iPhone and just dump her on my iPad and dump pictures off to, but Apple doesn't work that way. So at least not yet. So you can't do that. But everybody recommended an app called PhotoSync, which I immediately downloaded. I think it was like $2 or something. And it's awesome. It will see your camera library and all of your albums, and you can tell it, look, I want to sync my photos to, well, you can sync them to your Mac or your Windows machine if you have one of those. Now, David doesn't, because that's kind of his goal here, is to not travel with that. But you can run a free app on those that'll allow you to sync, and it'll pump right into iPhoto on your Mac and you know, be as though you plugged in and synced from that standpoint. It also will upload to Dropbox. It'll upload to Flickr, or it'll upload to an FTP server if you happen to have a hosting account somewhere, and you could probably set up S3 if you wanted as well, too. The cool part is, because there's other apps that do that, including Dropbox's own app, and you don't have to pay $2
yes.
for it.
But I verified that this morning.
Yeah.
That the Dropbox app does see the photos, and I tried mm-hmm. this. So that's
the problem. So
yeah, definitely get yourself a Dropbox account if you don't have one already.
Right.
And you can put your photos up in the cloud, which
the problem with doing it via Dropbox or really any of the other apps that would do this mm-hmm. is that they don't remember what you've done before. PhotoSync does.
Right.
So, you know, you can tell PhotoSync, go and sync everything that you haven't yet synced, and boom, it goes up. So you could use the camera connection kit from Apple, so $30, $2 for PhotoSync, and $32 later, David, you've got camera to SD card to your iPad. You can manage there, delete. You can even manipulate with, you know, one of the plethora of photo apps that are out there. Photoshop Express is even free on the iPad, right? And you can mess around with all that, get the pictures you want, delete the ones you don't want, and then tell PhotoSync, yep, go ahead and blast them all up to the cloud. And when you do the same thing the next day, you don't have to worry about it. It remembers which ones you've synced and which ones you haven't. So now, of course, depending on how much space you're using, you may also be stuck. You know, you've got to have the storage in the cloud. And of course, you can buy it from Dropbox if you don't get enough out of the gate. So,
yeah, that would be my one concern, is that I think right now, the iFi X2 that I have is an 8 gig card.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the iPad is, what are they up to now? What
16, 32 or 64, depending on.
Oh, okay.
How much you get.
All right. So if he's got the big boy iPad, then that'd be more than sufficient to, assuming he's not full of apps or podcasts or something.
Right. Well, and again, you know, as I had this conversation with Jeff Gamet earlier, and he reminded me, if they're shooting raw, that can,
right.
You know, that can change things very, very quickly in the space arena. But my guess is if you're doing that, you're not trying to do this. And it would be, you know, it's just, you're not going to upload all that to the cloud necessarily. You could, just might take a while. So.
Yeah. And the final thing that I like about the iFi is that they have a feature, which I believe would work in this scenario.
Yep.
Called endless memory. You're like,
Because it keeps uploading and then wiping itself out to make room
pretty
for more
much
pictures.
When you run their utility, configure the card, and I have mine set at 50%. Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
You say, okay, once you've synced, if there's less than this threshold of space available, then make it available to me.
Cool.
So in theory, as long as you sync on a regular basis or take the photos out of the iFi card and put them somewhere,
right. Then
you will never run into the situation where, because that's I've had that happen once or twice, and that's certainly not pleasant. Because especially at spur of the moment, you don't want to be figuring how to delete photos from your SD card.
Right.
Unless you know, the other thing he mentioned, you know, I would do. Yeah, I would have multiple options. I think they're relatively inexpensive. I would carry a couple with you.
Yeah,
have
definitely.
The Wi-Fi as the primary, but yeah. Have a couple of backup SD cards just in case.
So, I've got two other pieces of hardware that I found in my search here.
These were cool.
Yeah.
You know, I love these. They're, you know, you're going to be spending money.
Right.
But I hadn't even known these were out here. I was just looking at the SD card itself. So, go. These are very cool.
So, I started thinking, okay, you know, what this guy in essence wants to do is take something from an SD card and save it to a hard drive. And the only way I knew how to do this is with a computer. And of course, that is not true. There are devices that will allow you to take exactly that, an SD card, and copy it to a hard drive. Hypershop.com has a device they call the Color Space, and it will allow you to navigate through an SD card that you plugged in and save it off to its internal hard drive. It's got a little screen, shuttle controls, and they run anywhere from, the case alone, which you then have to put your own hard drive in, is $250. And then, of course, you can put drives in, and, you know, one with a 500 gig drive is $500. A 250 gig drive, I think, is about $400. So, you can do that. So that's one option. It's not cheap, but it's an option, and it keeps it portable for you. The other one, and I'll credit Adam Christensen, host of the MacCast, for pointing this out to me, is a device called AirStash. And what this is it's a USB flash drive with a built-in Wi-Fi access point. And then it's got a little bit of software on there that also lets it be a media streamer, like a media server. And what's cool is, yes, it's got the flash drive in there. So you can offload things from your iPod to it, because you can connect to it and save things out. So it acts as additional storage for your iPod, because it's doing it Wi-Fi. You're not trying to do it USB in the lap, and you just send it off and you're good to go. So very cool stuff. That's at airstash.com, and it's $100. So I think, you know, that's it. And then there's the app, and you're good to go. So pretty cool. And you plug in your card and off you go. So very, very, thank you for asking that question, David. This is actually a topic we've sort of been dancing around a little bit. And we've even had a question in our old queue here about using the iPad to store and manage photos. And you today finally pushed us down this path. So, John, it was actually you. You took the question and answered the first part. And I thought, all right, it's time to get the full answer. It's good. That's good.
Well, because I was, centered on...
on the iFi.
Well, because I'm an iFi type of guy.
Because you're that kind of guy. That's how
David
it works
followed
here.
Up. Now, the thing is, David followed up, and I don't know how to answer this, but he said, whose advice should I take? mine or yours? And my humble opinion is both.
Both. That's right.
No, we're going to leave it to David. David can make his own decision about the level of redundancy and how much he wants to spend. And I think he said he doesn't want to spend a lot of money. So.
Right.
But David, let us know what you come up with. The only thing in my back of my mind, Dave, is Wi-Fi in Europe any different? Is he going to run into any difficulties over there?
No, he won't.
Okay, they use the same frequencies. Okay.
Yeah, they have a couple extra channels available to him over there, but our devices will usually connect to him. So,
okay, I know for phones and stuff, you're definitely that there's problems. Well, no, not necessarily. No, certain phones there are problems.
Yeah, like right. Yeah, no, Wi-Fi is all the same. Yeah.
Okay, good. Yeah, that was a good one. I'm glad we cracked that one open.
Two shows ago, or three shows by number, in 328, we were talking about repairing permissions and how often you should do it. And Wesson wrote in, he says, I back up my main hard drive every night with Super Duper. One of the benefits is that disk permissions are repaired on the backed up drive during the process. And he's right. It does. It does a permissions repair before completing the backup. So, there you go. You get your permissions repaired every day using Super Duper. I don't know if Carbon Copy Cloner does that as well, but I definitely know that Super Duper does, which is good. Mm. I like that. Tyrone's question earlier mentioned that it was his second call this week, and indeed it is, because here's his first.
Hey, Don and Dave, this is Tyrone from Hiram, Georgia. I called a couple of years ago. I encouraged everybody to get AppleCare because I just got an iMac for free.
Well, I'm another recipient of Apple's largesse, and I'm getting a MacBook Pro to replace my 3.5-year-old MacBook Pro for free. Yeah,
warranty that's awesome.
Expired 6 months ago. They're still going to give me one. Anyway, I want to ask you, but I'm trying to do it the right way. I'm going to reinstall all my software instead of going from my Time Machine backup or my clone. I'm going to reinstall everything, but I want to carry over my email, my address book, my iPhoto library, and my iTunes library. Those are the four things I want to bring over. I don't want to recreate those, especially on my email addresses and all that stuff and all my address book. I'll install everything else because nothing else has a library. You know, I'll pull over my documents. But anyway, is there a standard document anywhere that you know of that says, okay, you want to carry, oh, and my keychain access too. I want to grab that as well. So I don't have to go through and rebuild that. But those are the things I want to carry over from the old machine to the new. And again, I have a clone backup of the old machine as well as my Time Machine backups. But is there a standard document somewhere that just says, okay, you want to move your email database? Here's how you do it. You want to move your iTunes? Here's where it is. You want to move your, you know, address book, you know, and iPhoto. Those are the four things I really don't want to rebuild those libraries from scratch. So if you guys could just tell us what files and the hierarchy I need to grab from my clone, I guess, and drag over, I would, so that I don't have to redo all my passwords and all that good stuff. Would really appreciate it. Keep up the good work, guys. Take care. This is where you cut me off if you need.
All right, and you are cut off. All right, so I'm gonna answer your question, Tyrone. I'm gonna answer his question because he wants to know where to find this stuff, and it is good.
But didn't he say the right way to do? Did I hear him say that at some point?
We're gonna get to that.
All right. I will defer to you.
Okay. So, all of this stuff is gonna be found in your home folder. For mail, it's in a weird spot. It's in home. Library, application support, mail. Did I get that right, John? Is that where mail is? As I'm saying it out loud, I have this fear that I've screwed something up. No, it's not in application support mail. It's in home library mail. I had it written down wrong. So home library mail, and then contact, your address book is in home library application support address book. The problem with that is there are a lot of apps that will maintain open access to your address book. So if you can, on the old machine first, go into address book, go into file, export, and make an address book archive that you can then import in to a live running address book as opposed to going in the background and changing the file. That would be better. But if you can't do this, and then after certainly these first three, you're going to want to reboot. Keychains is home library keychains, and you just move the contents over. iPhoto is in home pictures iPhoto library, and iTunes is in home music iTunes. Unless you've moved the location of all these, and then, you know, you're on your own, buddy. But that's where the stuff is by default. And you can just copy it over. Just make sure, first and foremost, no apps are running. None. Don't just quit the apps that you think matter, quit all apps, copy this data over. And then as soon as the copy's done, reboot and you should be okay. But you know, something interesting, and John, you alluded to this a little bit, doing this the right way. I get why you might want to do this, right? You don't want to inherit all the old cruft and all the old preferences and all of that stuff. But here's the thing. Even as you were leaving your message, Tyrone, you said, okay, I want to do mail and contacts and iPhoto and iTunes. And then when you listed it again, you said, oh yeah, and my keychain. Don't want to lose my keychain. Okay, what else did you forget, right? You know, you came up with four, now there's five. So you're 25% more already. You know, how many more things are there going to be that you think, oh yeah, I got to go get that. Oh yeah, I got to go get that. And that's why Apple created the Migration Assistant. And I think that's where you were going with your, let's do this the right way, John.
Yes. But I'm going to say is the Migration Assistant. I'm not going to give him a fist shake because I don't think he deserves it. Maybe a finger wag. Because to me, But no, I'm looking out for Tyrone because I want to save him time and frustration.
That's right.
Number one, I want to save him time of fiddling with it, like you said, to figure out all the things that you need to move over and all the places that the stuff could reside. And the thing is, for a lot of things, it's pretty straightforward. As you pointed out, Dave, it may all be in your iTunes folder or this folder or that folder. But a lot of times there's little bits scattered about. Yeah. And if you don't get one of them, then you're going to be spending more of your valuable time figuring out what went wrong.
Yep.
So, I mean, that's why they made Migration Assistant. For the most part,
I would like to hear from people. You know, we talk about how Migration Assistant has the potential to bring over what we'll commonly refer to as cruft, right? And but I, you know, I've used Migration Assistant a bunch, John. You have too. It's almost gotten to the point where I don't even consider another option. How many of you have actually experienced something where you say, oh man, Migration Assistant brought, you know, X problem over to my Mac and it caused me all kinds of grief? I know it's possible and I know we talk about it and acknowledge it, but I don't know that I've heard of any problems like this, especially in recent years. So if you have one, I'm curious. Send it in. We'll share the stories.
What I will suggest is that Migration Assistant does have an option. Looking in, surprise, knowledge base article HT4413, how to use Migration Assistant to transfer files from another Mac. There is a section where you can specify what user directories you would like to bring over.
Yeah.
You know, and there's desktop, documents, downloads, movies, music, pictures, blah, blah. You may want to exclude some of those. Like, for example, downloads. You probably don't need what's in there.
Right.
Documents, it depends. Music, I think, would cover your iTunes stuff when we bring over what you need. Pictures would cover, assuming that you go with what applications recommend as far as storing this data. So you may want to consider using Migration Assistant, but just digging in a little deeper and excluding the things that you.
Yeah.
But still, yeah, I'm with you. Though I got to say, when I migrated from the G5 to the Mini, it did bring over some cruft because it was also a Motorola machine.
Okay.
Though it didn't. It was more an annoyance when I looked through the console that it was trying to load stuff that was PowerPC and just didn't work. And it didn't hurt the system. It didn't crash violently. It just was stuff where it said, oh, I don't know what this is. I don't really like it, so I'm not going to run it. Or I can't find a library that does this or that. So it was more an annoyance than a showstopper.
Sure.
So I'm with you is I don't know of any, you know, I told you I helped my mom also go from a Motorola machine to a Intel MacBook.
Right.
And everything went swimmingly. And actually, she was shocked. She's like, it looks the same. I'm like, yeah, that's how it works.
That's the point.
Her desktop was the same. All the documents were where they were. It was a continuous user experience.
Right.
And yeah, so I'm with you. I honestly would like to hear from people that have had a bad experience using Migration Assistant and what, if anything, happened that ruined your day or you didn't like about,
yeah, yeah,
about the tool.
Exactly. You know, we mentioned that we want you to send these things in, but we didn't tell you where to send them. So you can send to feedback@macgeekab.com.
Yeah, that's right.
Was I too definitive about that, John?
Well, I think you want to slow it down and maybe say feedback@macgeekab.com.
Or maybe even feedback@macgeekab.com. Or 206-666-GEEK, which is
4335.
You can contact us on our Facebook page, facebook.com/MacGeekGab. We've actually been answering some questions there, and it's nice because it provides a little public discussion. The MacGeekGab forums, I think, are still a better place for it because you can sort all the problems and you can see the topics. It works out really well, actually. It works out way better than I ever expected. It's a great place. And we've got a killer community. Those of you that are out there, not just asking questions, but answering questions. So there's the Mac Geek Gab forums too, which is good
Skype
stuff.
Skype, right?
Yeah. You can send in a question with Skype. That's right. Skype, Mac Geek Gab. It's not Skype. Don't Skype it to Skype. That won't help anyone.
No. Nope.
But if you Skype it to Mac Geek Gab, it'll help you and maybe other listeners too. So that's cool.
And, iTunes comments always
appreciated.
Appreciate it.
Yeah. All right. We have questions from at least one, if not two, Scotts. And we will address the first one here and see where we go. And maybe we'll go on to the next. Scott writes, is there an easy to use encryption program for the Mac that works along the lines of something like I simply right click a file, select encrypt, enter a password, and then right click a file, select decrypt, and type the password? I know I can use tools like Disk Utility and TrueCrypt, but I don't want all the additional steps of having to create an encrypted disk image. I just want to encrypt ad hoc files on the fly. Is there such a tool, John?
The first suggestion that I had was that there is a tool, and the price is right, Dave. It's free. Here's the downside, though. It didn't quite meet his expectations. But I thought I'd give it a shot. So if you go to the terminal, there's Zip.
Okay. You know what? Yeah. 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 Our old friend Zip.
Well, Zip has, if you do Zip from the terminal, the format of the command is as follows. Zip space destination file name in that what you want the encrypted file to be called, then a space and the source file name, assuming you're in the directory with that source file name, space dash E. What is dash E? Encrypt. And what it does is ask for a password, and that is your encryption key. So I offered that up.
Cool.
And unzip, of course, is the complement of that, where if you say unzip and a file is encrypted, it'll say, well, dude, what's the password? Right. So that met his needs for encrypting, but he said, well, the person...
It meets his needs.
It could.
Could meet his needs. Okay.
Then he said, well, the person I'm dealing with is not very technical, and I don't want to go in the terminal. I'll assume they're on the Mac. So, all right, had to dig a little deeper. And so I dug a little deeper, and I found a utility called MEO. I haven't really used this a lot, but I did find something. It's in the Apple download section. So okay. I'll assume that it's legitimate. Well, he was asking for two things. You know, he said, I'd be willing to pay for something, but I'd like something free. Well, I assumed he'd like something free. Sure. So something called MEO file encryption for Mac 1.11.
Okay.
It's dated 2009. It's freeware. I checked it out. Very basically, it uses TripleDes or Blowfish as the encryption algorithms, which are not the greatest, but I think good enough. You want to pick a good passphrase or password for the file. Sure. So I suggested that, but I would say for something commercial, Dave, stuff it, I think.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I forgot all about
Stuff It.
Stuff
It is out there. And they've got Stuff It is still out there. Now they have their proprietary format, but they also deal with zip files. And they do offer encrypted archives. So I think the thing is, I said to him, I believe when I wrote back, what is it? So it's, and I think he's over in the UK, or, well, I'm not going to get in the whole mess of what the UK is, but he's across the pond. Let's put it that way. Yeah. And it's $30 US. So,
okay.
And he said he's willing to pay something. So if it's worth it for him to pay $30, then I think Stuff It would be the best commercial option that would offer encrypted file services. And from what I saw, it's cross-platform too. So I assume the person on the other end is Mac, but if they're not, if they're PC, then this would also be a good solution. So that's what I had to offer.
So would there also be the option of perhaps creating an automator action that you could drop a file onto that then performed this zip operation, so you don't have to go to the Finder? And if you can do that, then you could also add it to the actions, the folder actions folder, you know, and you're good to go, right? I mean, I think you could do this.
That is an awesome suggestion, and I'm looking forward to what you have. What you're going to put together.
It really wouldn't be that difficult, right? I mean, you take the input file.
Okay. Next show, I want to see what you came up with.
Okay. Well, and then you just
kind of dug yourself a hole here.
You know? You run it into the terminal and that's it. And you just run a command line script using your zip thing and it would work.
All right. I'm going to challenge
you this?
Because yes.
Okay.
Come on, man.
All right.
it didn't appear to be as straightforward as I thought doing it either through Automator or Apple Script.
Huh.
So that's all I'll say.
Okay. Yeah.
No, but you're the smart one here. Try it. But it wasn't as straightforward. I thought there would be a service in Automator that would make this easy.
No.
You'd
have to do it where you pipe it out to a terminal command.
Yeah, and I couldn't find something in a cursory examination of Automator or Apple Script that would make this something I could do in, you know, 5 minutes.
Yeah, so. I think it is a 5 minute thing. I'll have to mess with it, but yeah, I think it's pretty easy.
Well,
yeah.
I also found that they were kind of questionable. I mean, I wasn't sure where they came from, but I did see some people that had put together either Apple scripts or Automator Actions that did this, but none of them were.
Oh, you look at the script and see what it does.
Yeah, and I did, but still, you know, I didn't look through it. I didn't want to recommend a, like, one was from, like, Jolly Roger, and I'm like, oh, come
on. That doesn't sound very good.
Yeah, no. yeah, for those who don't know, but Jolly Roger is a pirate. I would not use a encryption application from someone whose name is Jolly Roger, so.
Yeah.
But no,
I try not to judge a book by its cover, but.
No, I thought it would be great. I thought I would find an Automator Action saying pipe to terminal command, and I couldn't find it. Maybe I missed it. So,
oh
no, go for it, man.
Oh no, so
there's your homework. There's your homework.
Oh, there is an Automator Action to run the terminal, or maybe you just do Apple Script, right? I mean that's probably the way
to do it.
Yeah,
I'm telling you, man. Next show.
I think there's a pretty easy way. All right,
that's what I thought. I'm saying, you know, you're the smart one.
Let's see. Terminal command with Automator. Right? I mean, I thought it was pretty straightforward. I'm pulling up Automator here to see if I can do this on the fly.
Oh, let's not do it. Oh, come on.
All right. Well, you know, isn't there a run shell script action?
I thought there would be. I couldn't find it. So
that's what it is. It's called run shell script.
All right, so then you would need to create a shell script with the terminal command. Okay.
Well, you mean right, that's it. No. You put it right in the thing. I mean, you build the script inside your Automator application, so you don't need to create it on the disk. You just put whatever your zip command is, zip, ba, 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 and it'll take the, you can take the input as arguments or whatever you want, and you're good to go. I think that's it. I think it's that simple. So even you can do it. That came out wrong. I didn't mean it that way.
Yes, you did.
No, I didn't.
No. Put something together for the next show.
You've got it, though. I already gave you your answer. It's a run shell script. That's it. You're good to go.
Under Automator, what? So Automator library, files and folders?
I don't know. I just searched. Just put in run. Just type run in the little search thing there.
Run shell script.
Hey, there it is. Go.
Yeah. All right, but you got to make a shell script.
No, you just type it in right there. That's what I'm saying. You quite literally take the zip command that you wanted to.
Oh, there we go. Okay.
There it is. So that was the missing piece of knowledge, is you didn't know how to interface that with the terminal. Yeah, it works pretty well. And you can, you know, you can assign things to variables so you could pull a file.
Well, here's
in.
What annoys me is that I was expecting to find that in files and folders. Now, what library?
Oh, I don't know.
See,
yeah, I
in
know
the actions. That okay, is
a,
no, no, no.
That you, is a problem with Automator. You're right. Is it? There's stuff is everywhere, and it's not entirely the most intuitive thing.
Right. I was expecting if I was in the files and folders library category, I would see a run shell script.
Right.
Action available to me, and I didn't. So that's why I gave up on that. Okay.
Is it under utilities? It might be under utilities.
Let's see. Hold on. Could be. We're live here, folks.
That's right.
Utilities.
Yeah, it is. It's under utilities where you can also run
shell script. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Then I'm with you. Yeah. That's a. All right. Yeah.
It's Automator's wacky.
Expect.
You know, Sal and his team, they're a crazy bunch, but the thing works. So that's a good thing.
Okay. So then you would paste in what I said the terminal command was, and then you build your Automator action.
Yeah.
And I would assume it would prompt you at that point for the password when you build the.
Well,
that
would be the interesting thing is to see how you need to interact with that, because what you might need to do is have Automator grab the password, you know, use get variable in Automator and then put that in a variable and then build the password into the zip, you know, shell script command. I don't know. That's what you'd have to test. But yeah, there you go. It's good stuff.
Okay. That'd be the good point. Yeah, that'd be the interesting. Would it stop and prompt you with some sort of?
It would if you do.
Would it
get
be smart
variable.
Enough to say, "Oh, you're prompting the user for something. Let me put up a dialogue," or who knows?
Mm-mm.
Okay, I'll explore that.
Yeah, Yeah, that's where it gets interesting. That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Good one. Okay. Yeah. Nice. Story. But no, I learned something about Automator. It's
that it's wacky.
Finding what you need is more difficult than I thought.
Yes, that is always true in Automator. And it, you know, it's one of those things. It's ultimately flexible right up until you hit its wall. And when you hit that wall, there's no going up, over, down, or under. You know, it's over. It's like, that's it. Yep, this is the limit. And I guess, you know, I guess actually you can go under the wall because you can run AppleScript or you can run terminal commands and do some stuff. But
sweet.
Yeah, you know. All right. I still have another Automator problem I want to run through with you, but I need to get you more well versed in Automator before I ask the question. So this is part of my my MO here.
I told you I wrote my Automator to import my photos into Aperture. So I'm not a total noob.
Yeah. Well, here's what I want to do. I'll tell you. In fact, I'll tell all of the listeners. I don't know why I'm keeping this secret. I want to be able, and this has to do with the Automator. Workflow that I use to produce the show. Like, as soon as we finish recording, which is going to be, you know, as soon as I shut up here, I take the file and I dump it into an Automator action that then goes and does all this stuff. Well, especially now that we've started doing our premium show, there's sometimes where I need to manipulate the file name, and my action goes and converts in iTunes and saves it out and then uploads it with Transmit and all that. But I want to be able to control the file name. And what I cannot seem to do for the life of me is rename a file based on input from the user in the middle of the script. I want it to say, do you want to rename the file? Or if so, type something here and just let it do it. And I just can't figure it out. So I don't know. You know, that's my thing. And maybe I do need, because I can pull a variable, but the file rename action won't take a variable, which is like, yeah, that's the thing. So maybe I need to use this run shell script and do my rename with an MV command. You know what I mean? And do it that way. Yeah, but why do I have to? Because that's the walls, right? That's what I'm saying about Automator. You hit these walls. So if anybody out there knows, or John, if you figure it out, that would save me. I would kiss your feet. It would be awesome. Unless you don't want me to kiss your feet, and then I'll just say thanks.
I don't know how I feel about that.
All right. Well, Michael Johnston, we can ask him how he feels about it. Michael Johnston is from We Have Communicators podcast. He also converts this show to AAC for us and for you. Cashfly.com provides all the bandwidth. The podcast marketplace includes the A5 desktop speakers from Audio Engine, Yojimbo from Barebone Software, PDF Pen and PDF Pen Pro from Smile, Notebook from Circus Ponies, and Stitcher with promo code MGG, all through Backbeat Media. John, unless you've got something else to add, we're out of here.
I got nothing.
Awesome.
It's a good one.
Fun show. Thanks for sticking around. Thanks for subscribing. Thanks for participating, folks. We love doing this. We love the fact that you do it with us.
Thanks for being you.
Oh, we forgot Cool Stuff Found. Well, more next time. We'll just have to double up on Cool Stuff Found next time, but it looks like for this one, we got caught.